The last time I outlined what I was going to do, and I began with the case studies, and I didn't get very much further than that, because partly because of my own narration, probably that took too long, and partly because of the discussion that followed. But I expect to just to continue, and the basic outline of what I was going to do was to begin with case studies, and the common denominator among all of these case studies was a denial of death and an underlying anxiety, the anxiety you could see in the parents of the mongoloid child that had the intestinal obstruction and were unwilling to accept that child, and they let the baby die. I don't want to go through the cases again, but that was the common denominator among all of the cases. Today, in the second portion, I was going to explain why there was or is such a denial of death. And I will begin with an observation which Kubler-Ross, the famous psychiatrist, makes in hospitals, patients are not dying. That is one of the important observations that she had made when she tried to set up her institute in Chicago at the University of Chicago. She went around to the physicians to ask for permission to talk to dying patients and to try to determine the dynamics of dying and the attitude of the patients. And the interesting observation that she had made was that the physicians denied that there was dying going on in the hospitals. She said in one portion of her book, and also she reiterated that same observation in television interviews, that physicians said, "We have no dying patients," which is a very interesting observation, because we know that every man dies, and probably the place where they die is in hospitals today, because both birth and death takes place in hospitals. I have invented a term for this. Maybe somebody else has used it, I'm not sure, but I would call this denial of fear of death thanatophobia, from the Greek words thanatos, death, and phobia, fear. Fear of death, thanatophobia. It's a cultural phenomenon of the first rank. Now, the interesting thing in our culture today is that we are very much becoming aware of that. We are beginning to understand that our culture is denying death, and for that reason we have a rash of seminars on death and dying going across the country, taking place on college campuses, but not only there, also in places like this. People talk about death and dying. One student told me, "Now that the whole issue is out in the open, we are much more honest with death and we can all accept death." I would like to reject that thesis. I think the reason why hospitals deny, and physicians in particular, deny death, I don't think that all of them do, but the reason why physicians and hospitals and all of us really deny death is because our culture has, with the beginning of the scientific attitude, begun to think about reality in a radically different way than we had before. And we are all committed to this way of thinking. We are, this attitude, this way of proceeding, which of course is especially prevalent in the highly sophisticated hospitals, is like the air that we breathe or like the fish for the water. We cannot get away from that, and that is the reason why there is such a prevalent denial of death. And even though we can become aware of this attitude, it cannot be overcome also simply. Now, Ernest Becker has, in a book that we have here in the bookstore and also in the library, I have observed, has written about this cultural hang-up that we have. His book is called Denial of Death, and it's a book very worthwhile owning and reading. I mention this book because here those cultural presuppositions are analyzed, which cause all of us, patients, relatives of patients, physicians, hospitals, everyone, to deny death. And what I mean with death here is not the simple death that we that occurs at the end of our life, but rather I also wanted to clarify this in relation to the case studies that I had presented earlier. But rather is an inability to cope with crises. An inability to cope with crises. Paul tells us that we die daily in Christ. We know as Christians, but also secular philosophy knows about those little deaths that we die every day. And I had mentioned the last time in the context of one of the case studies that Kubler-Ross talks about patients who are capable of dealing with crises during their life, and those are able also to cope with the final crisis that comes at the end of their life. But those patients that are incapable of dealing with the crises during their daily life and during their the progression of their life are the ones who are also incapable of coming to the final stage in her five stages, the stage of acceptance. I think I have mentioned these stages the last time, but I feel that I must condense everything here very much. In my classes I take much more time. Kubler-Ross is famous for her five stages in dying. Denial is the first. That is, when patients are confronted with the news that they have a disease that cannot be cured, they go through these five stages. It's the psychodynamics of coming to grips with the fact of dying. The first stage is denial. It manifests itself in the inability even to hear the facts. But Kubler-Ross always emphasizes that the patients hear very well, but they act as if they don't hear the facts about their disease. The second stage is anger, an indication that they have in fact very well understood. They are angry that it should happen to them. The third stage is bargaining. They bargain with the physicians. I will do what you ask me. I will go to the x-ray room if you will give me a cigarette to smoke, if you will permit me to see my sons and my daughters on the weekend, if you will permit me to leave the hospital for a few days. This is the stage of bargaining. And then comes depression, the fourth stage, which I think is in many ways the most significant. In the depression stage, patients behave very much like other patients in psychiatric wards who have depressions. You cannot talk to them. They are most difficult to deal with. And for that reason, it is most easy for us to exercise our own denial of death with them. Because it's, I don't know whether you have ever met a depressive a person. You can talk to him. It's just like oil, water running down an oil cloth. It is impossible to talk to such a patient. They just turn away. Sometimes they may make a sarcastic remark. And indeed, the sarcastic remark is very fitting. Because in comparison to what they have to face, everything that we do is trivial. And it is, for that reason, very difficult to get through to them, because it is almost impossible to strike a note of concern with them. And Professor Kubler-Ross says that few patients only make it through the fourth stage. But those who do come to the stage of acceptance. Now, the point that I wanted to make, and the point that Ernest Becker makes, is that we go through these stages throughout life generally. It's not only at the end of life, when we are confronted with death, that we might go through some of these stages, but rather throughout every day in life. As soon as we confront a threatening situation, we may act like that. We may, in fact, deny. It's quite typical, for example, to observe the child that confronts a threatening situation, and for the child simply to deny that there is any threat. I didn't really care for that ball, or I didn't really want to go swimming anyway. Deny it. Very simple. It begins with the child, and we all do it every day, to a greater or lesser degree. And I'm sure that you observe yourself. Some of you are probably capable of coping with crises and others are not. Now, to reiterate again a point that I wanted to make, and that was the common denominator in all of the case studies, Heidegger was one, but there were other philosophers and theologians, incidentally, too, who have followed these philosophers. Ultimately, at the end of Any activity that we do in life is, or at the end of life itself, of course, is death. And death is the final foe that threatens all of life. And for that reason, death is that symbol of a threat and the fear of death. Anxiety, as it is sometimes called. And Heidegger makes a distinction between fear and anxiety, Furcht und Angst in German. Now, another thesis of Ernest Becker is that because of this basic fear of death, we put up fronts. And the scientific attitude that we have developed is essentially, this is the thesis of Ernest Becker's book, Denial of Death. The whole scientific apparatus, the tremendously impressive civilization that has come out of the West, is a result of this basic underlying fear of death, which is the task of humankind. We put up a huge front in order to stave off final disaster. We must not fail. Now, the medical establishment is very much a part of that, you see. And that is ultimately the reason why there is denial of death. And it is not as simple as some people say, now we have confronted the issue, we have brought it up in the open, and we can cope with death, psychologically perhaps. But when a patient comes to the hospital needing resuscitation, of course you use the apparatus. Of course you are not going to let the patient die, because that's the ethos of the physician. I am reminded of a little poem by the very humorous but very deeply probing German Jewish poet Christian Morgenstern, who has written about the realities of life. And I don't think this little poem is translated, so I must paraphrase the poem for you. It's called The Sandwich Wrapper in the Forest. And for me, this little poem characterizes in a simple way what Ernest Becker, and incidentally also the philosopher Heidegger, has been saying about the civilatory process of our Western civilization being in fact a front to eliminate the fear of death, to overcome the foe of death. The sandwich wrapper in the forest is left by some picnicking party in the forest, and fall comes. And it becomes cold, and the heavy winds and the snows come, and the sandwich wrapper, out of sheer fear of being deserted, and out of sheer fear of dying in the cold, begins to fly. And we indeed have begun to fly in the Western civilization, and I just wonder whether possibly this thesis of Ernest Becker and the thesis of Heidegger, which I find in some ways more impressive even than Ernest Becker. Ernest Becker popularizes a great deal of philosophy that has gone before. Whether, in fact, perhaps this philosophy is not correct. I don't want to go any further than that. I have my own opinions about this thesis, but I don't want to burn you with that. I just would like to mention to you that from the Christian perspective, this thesis becomes very interesting, because after all, the death of Christ has become the death for all of mankind, has become the death of sin. And possibly the fear of death can be overcome much better on the cross than with the scientific project. But again, that is merely a thesis, and I would like just to throw it out at this moment. In any case, this is the reason why in hospitals prevalent fear of death is met by patients, physicians, relatives. Now, what I can do is either to draw out the reasons, historically the reasons, why the fear of death has grown in our Western civilization. And I do not mean here now the existential fear of death, but rather the scientific, this cultural preoccupation that we have. Or I could use two case studies to indicate how we are attempting to overcome the fear of death. Let me use two case studies first. And possibly in the discussion then, I hope that maybe these case studies will stimulate some discussions, and please feel free also to draw upon the case studies that I've used earlier at the first meeting. The one case study concerns a child born with a myelomeningocele. And I can draw up a fictitious case study because it's a child born with a myelomeningocele is a very serious condition. Now, Raymond Duff is a neonatologist at Yale University Medical Center.
What is it?
Yeah, I will explain. Yeah, Raymond Duff is a neonatologist at Yale University Medical Center. And he has argued that children born with a myelomeningocele should be permitted to die. Perhaps now I should explain the reasons why he argues that way. And in that process, I must explain the disease. The myelomeningocele is an opening of the spinal cord towards the lower part of the spinal cord. This morning it was announced that my wife is a physician, and I've asked her whether possibly she should explain some of these medical things, but she told me, you may as well, since you have prepared yourself for this, you may as well explain it. And I've explained, in fact, often to my students this condition. But if I'm wrong, perhaps you can correct me. Now, the way it has been explained to me, and I explain it in layman's terms because I'm a layman myself, is that the spinal cord in the early embryological development is like a sheet of paper, a long sheet of paper, and then curves slowly and forms a tube. It's open on both ends. In the course of time, it closes on both ends. But at first it's open. Now, with some children, the closing process does not occur. And of course, you know the spinal cord is the lower part of our rump, and the upper part ends in the brain. Now, for that reason, because the spinal cord stays, usually it stays open at the bottom and at the top it closes, but very often the hydrocephalus, the waterhead, is associated. It's essentially part of the same condition. Children with a myelomeningocele also very often have a waterhead, that is a hydrocephalus. Now, the hydrocephalus is very easy to cure, comparatively speaking. But all kinds of myths are prevailing. But the myelomeningocele is a very serious condition indeed, because you have an opening of the spinal cord, and you notice it first by the baby being born with a bubble on its back. Sometimes, in fact, it's open. But in most cases, I understand there is a thin membrane over that bubble. It can be operated away, but that is, the spinal cord can, by an operative process, be closed, and therefore the back can become smooth and the child can operate, but not in the normal way. Usually, paralysis from that place down develops. Now, because of that, sometimes there is retardation involved, but most of the time not. Sometimes there is also retardation involved with a hydrocephalus. Now, my little remark that all kinds of myths prevail relating hydrocephalus should perhaps be explained. Only about 2 months ago, I read an article about which some colleagues were very much annoyed in the medical center. In fact, they pointed it out to me. Written by a Catholic priest. He says that children born with a hydrocephalus, the intelligence of children born with a hydrocephalus is no more than the intelligence of a pigeon. That is a simple, very simple, crude mistake. That's not true at all. Immediately, one physician who told me that, immediately she took me to a room in which a child was on the pediatrics ward, a child that had a hydrocephalus. And she showed me on the neck and also on the head the place where a shunt had been put in. I had known before that that the hydrocephalus can be cured fairly easily by a shunt. The problem is, and here my medical knowledge falls down somewhat, that water accumulates around the brain and puts very much pressure on the brain, and if it is not, if that pressure is not relieved, retardation sets in, and the retardation can be very, very severe. And indeed, once upon a time, hydrocephalus was a very severe condition. But now this is no longer true, because it is possible to put in a shunt and to drain off the shunt is put into the lymph system at the base of the neck, and it drains off the water into the lymph system, and it is thereby eliminated from the organism. And I saw this lovely 8-year-old boy with blonde hair, and he was perfectly normal. You could still see the scars, which will in the course of time become smaller, on his face. She showed it to me. One scar was behind the ear. The hair was a little bit raised away, but all of that will be overcome. The child was a perfectly normal child. And this priest in the Journal of the American Medical Association writes an article about hydrocephalus children, the intelligence of hydrocephalus children being no more than the intelligence of a pigeon. It's an outrage, and many myths still prevail. Modern medicine indeed can do a great deal. But the other part of that condition, namely the myelomeningocele, is very much more serious. And because it is more serious, Ray Duff, who plugs into this whole attitude of overcoming our thanatophobia, overcoming our fear of death, argues that children born with a myelomeningocele, he does not talk specifically about the hydrocephalus, should be permitted to die if the parents agree with that. Now, there is a whole theory behind Ray Duff's attitude. He insists that he does not want them to make the decision for the children, but rather the parents should make the decision. And indeed, he is most dialogical in his whole approach. He is a wonderful person, and he indeed places the facts about the condition before the parents in a very understanding way. But the implication is always that parents can and possibly should decide to let such children die. He is only so much more sophisticated about it because he knows about this basic denial of death that is prevalent in our civilization. Now, this is the one case that we could possibly talk about. I think in the way in which I have presented the condition of the myelomeningocele indicates already how I stand. But I hope to present it as fairly as possible. The second case, I don't know whether you would like to discuss now. You might want to raise some questions about it.
You didn't make clear what happens if the surgery is not performed to eliminate the space.
Yes, I did not indicate that. I don't know. It's always performed. I was never told.
Maybe I can mention something. If in a myelomeningocele the surgery is not performed, it depends whether there are nerves included in the little sac or not. If there are no nerve strands attached, then the seal might break open and infection occurs. And this is the reason why usually surgery is done, because to prevent infection. If the seal breaks open. If there are nerve strains attached or go into the sac, then it is called a myelomeningocele. And then surgery is also necessary because of prevention of infection. But then always you have to, you have the risk, or you have already some paralysis, usually from that base where the nerve roots start. So you don't prevent the paralysis by surgery, but you can prevent that the seal breaks open. And the question is usually when the child is born, shall we do the surgery right away or shall we wait? And I have experienced several cases in the newborn nursery where children were born with a meningocele only and with a myelomeningocele. And I saw both decisions happen. And one child especially, the child is now 2 years old, no surgery was done until the child was about 8 months old. The child got infections, the child got a hydrocephalus, and finally they decided to operate. The child is now paralyzed and would have been paralyzed anyway, but the child went through many difficulties and is now a child that is well developed for his age, is 2 years old, and is not retarded. The other two cases I experienced were the surgery was done right away after birth because the neurosurgeons feared infection. They opened the seal, they covered it with a skin, and the children did very well. and one of the children did not develop a hydrocephalus because of his less serious condition. But the ethical question is, can you just wait? That's one group of neurosurgeons that just wait and see what happens. If the child deteriorates and develops a hydrocephalus, they say, okay, the child will be retarded anyway, infection will set in, the child is paralyzed, the child has no control about bladder and intestine, so we just let the child deteriorate because it would not be a nice life for this child to live. And the other group of neurosurgeons does everything possible, because you never know how a child will develop. And that is one thing that comes to my mind. If you don't know, then you have to do everything possible in the hope that this child might have a better life expectancy.
Yes, but that desire to do anything possible, of course, is part of what the physicians do generally, and specifically Kubler-Ross and many others say that is a hang-up of civilization, that's a hang-up specifically of the hospitals. And that's also the reason why the first group of the neurosurgeons don't agree with that with that attitude.
Is it a hang-up of the hospitals, or is it a hang-up of our society that we don't want to take the time to care for these children, and not only these children, you know, other types of illness?
Yes, I sense that you side with the latter group of the neurosurgeons.
No, but I'm questioning the fact that, you know, you try to have this... you know, we always want everything perfect and everything, and I think a lot of growth comes out of dealing with these things in our society.
Yes. I think it is more sophisticated, not just wanting to care. Personally, my own feeling in this instance would be to do anything possible, as my wife's prejudice also came through in the way in which she described it. And indeed, I would also very much disagree with those neurosurgeons who opted not to operate. But we should not underestimate the arguments behind their position. We should not underestimate the arguments. The arguments come out of an insight that our society has a thanatophobia, that we are basically fearful of facing crisis situations, and for that reason we should allow, under certain circumstances, death to prevail.
In other words, you're saying that there is a group who are saying, let's stop being afraid of death.
Yes, that's right. Raymond Duff is a leading advocate. He travels throughout the country and he writes articles on this issue. And he is a neonatologist, that is a person who is concerned in he's a pediatric neonatologist. He's concerned with children that are just born.
It seems that this notion of our fear of death may be related somehow to our heritage of hope. Do we hope because we fear death? Why do we hope? The notion of wanting to save these children and to help them, I think, is a notion of hope. I think the end result of this fear of death would be that hope comes out of fear of death, which goes along with scripture too, to some degree.
Well, you see, the fear of death, or the fear of the incapability of dealing with a crisis situation, is essentially the incapability of dealing with something that we have ourselves not planned, that is, over which we are not in control. Now, maybe I can just briefly explain the historical reasons for this attitude. Essentially, in the emerging scientific mentality, which Heidegger calls the instrumental mentality that is prevalent today, with Descartes, for example, the philosopher Descartes of the 17th century, new Platonism emerged. And you remember that Plato always had a bias against the physical entities, against the physical body, very much in distinction to the Hebrew attitude and the Christian attitude over against the body. Rather mind and things in Descartes' version, this is a revival of the Platonic thought in Descartes' version, things that can be mathematically pinned down are the only things that are true. Now, from that, science and its sister technology, which is the implementation of science, has grown and it has helped life immensely. But at the same time, it has abstracted life immensely also. And we have been capable and are advancing still very much in this enterprise in which we have set out to eliminate all of those things which happen, all of those things over which we are not in control. And we have set out the cultural task to do everything, to create the whole universe in our image, so that nothing is there which we have not ourselves created. And the more we do that, the more we fear that we might fail. Now, there are other strands in the physician's ethos to save life, namely the priestly tradition also. I do not only want to say that this is the basic attitude, but it is very prevalent. For example, a hospital tries to be as advanced as possible. It tries to have, for example, only 10 or 15 years ago, 10 years ago, most hospitals didn't have incubators, now, or resuscitators. Now we have incubators and resuscitators, and babies that are born very premature are put into incubators and are maintained alive. Of course, we must attempt to save. But you see, this whole ethos goes much further than that. Advanced hospitals try to have, I heard a lecture about a year ago in the Albany Medical Center, that aspired to get a helicopter service. Some physician from some other medical center in the country came and showed slides and showed how helicopters go out to the provinces, to the suburbs of some big metropolitan area, and get the endangered premature babies very quickly to the hospital. I ask myself, how far can technology go? That's the one side of the whole issue. But you see, the mandate is there, and it goes on and on. And if I understand Heidegger and Ernest Becker correctly, they say that essentially the fear of being confronted with something over which we are not in control, something that simply happens, the happening, this fear lies at the root of this whole scientific technological enterprise.
I still see it as being, we have two views. I can see your scientific from Plato on up, how that builds up. But in the scriptures, we always are seeking the strength, and we're seeking hope and help from God,
yes,
this type of thing, because we overthink we have, over which we have no control.
Yes.
And yet science, they want to control things. We want to get a nice analysis and be able to control these things.
Yes.
But even so, you go to the hospital, you talk to your doctor, you talk to your physician, the good ones will tell you that they really, very often in your case, they may not know anything about it. They'll tell you, I do not know much. All we can do is hope.
Yes.
If this may succeed, this may not succeed. I feel that I have to dismiss the notion that society, our society, has a basic fear of death. I feel that there may be portions of our society that may have that, and the seeking of knowledge and the seeking of using all the tools that God gave us to help man in his fulfillment, and that's his physical fulfillment too. If he can be helped physically, mentally, he may be of great benefit to himself, God and man. But this notion of fear of death, I'm not so sure that's right. It just seems strange to, it's a strange notion to me. I never thought of this before.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why. But, even in technology, I can't see a fear of death coming into it.
Well, you
it seems like hope, the Hippocratic Oath, if I understand it, I don't know much about it, but even that, that starts back in our Greek times. It still seems to be a notion of hope for this person to live, not the fear that this person will die, with the hope that he will live. I just have that.
Well, the point that Kubler-Ross is always making is that patients are treated like things. And when you remember the first ventures into anatomy, they could be taken, namely to open up the body and to look actually inside how the body looks. Those hurdles to do that could be taken only because the body was looked at in a very different way than it had been before, namely in the scientific way. It was understood that muscles are connected to bones like levers, and they pull, you know, like, and in fact the human body was outlined like, you know, like a machine. It was understood like a machine. And in fact, this is what Kubler-Ross says, the physical body is very often treated like a machine. Now there are great disagreements within the medical community. Some look at the physical body more like a machine. I tend to think surgeons do that. And others less, like internists or psychiatrists.
Excuse me, is that an ethical question then? How a physician or doctors look at the body as a human being or as a machine? Is there some ethical...
Well, you see, I mean, that question was also asked in the first discussion that I carried on. Mm-hmm. If you don't understand what moves a physician, then you don't understand the reasons why he makes certain ethical decisions. And for that reason, it's not adequate simply to say, shall we abort or shall we not abort? Shall we have a ruling for abortion or not? Or shall we have a death sentence or not? Yes, for me, this is all very much related. Death and dying, abortion, death sentence, you see, these are all related. And we have a cultural phenomenon in our time right now that is prone, that has a hang-up with death. And... There are reasons behind ethical dispositions. And for that reason, you must outline them. If you do not do that, then you don't understand why certain ethical decisions are made. And for that reason, it's legitimate, in fact mandatory, in any debate on ethical points of view to outline the positions that are the historical reasons for certain positions that are taken. I would say, much more important, to buttress your point of view, is the Christian notion, thou shalt not kill. The command, thou shalt not kill. And this goes contrary, of course, to the basic... I am myself ambivalent in this whole debate. Increasingly, I am going contrary to the notion that you should simply let patients die. Increasingly, I think that you should save wherever possible, but... under certain circumstances, indeed, commit passive euthanasia. I would not be in favor of active euthanasia. Go ahead.
But my earlier question related to your last comment, I have been involved as a pastor in some situations where passive euthanasia has in fact been approved and so on. And it has seemed to me, in some of those cases, where the decision was made, we're going to let this patient die,
yes,
that it would be far more compassionate to have active euthanasia. That to just stand there, you know the patient is dying anyway, and the patient will die in a week, to let the patient who is not conscious of anything, except possibly the pain and the anguish and everything else, I know that's a terribly difficult decision, but I wonder if there are not some situations in which active euthanasia would be the more compassionate choice.
Yes, that's right. And it's reasonable to do that, to think that way. And Radoff, in fact, advocates active euthanasia for severely afflicted myelomeningocele children. But not only...
Well, that's one example of a baby, I know, who was born. The doctor examined the baby and saw him very carefully what they could do. There's nothing we can do. The child had no elimination facilities, so there's nothing we can do to replace it. They just permit certain things to happen that just seems to me cruel.
Yes.
I think you have to be awfully careful in that, though.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that. Be careful, but I think careful needs to be matched with compassion.
That's right. I'm a physician, and I've seen all too many people who, after all of our intensive treatments, we've decided that there's nothing we can do. You disconnect everything, and the patient gets better and goes back to a reasonably useful life. So you have to be awfully careful,
yes,
about being able to make that decision to do something active to stop the life. And that's why I personally could never do that. I can let nature take its course, because sometimes we get pretty surprised by what nature does, but I cannot do something active.
Yes. One argument that physicians...
The one thing you did, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah, one argument that physicians always use is, very frequently use, let's keep the options open.
Mm-hmm.
We never know what is going to happen, so we should at least keep the options open. But you see, in some cases, like one of the case studies that I had presented the first time was on this aging woman The attitude that the son had over against her was perhaps typical of what physicians frequently do.
Yeah, I find an easy way to handle that.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really bother me. I can, even if the family wants you to keep the intravenous going and so forth, there are easy things you can do to let nature take its course, like slow down the IV, put less nutrients in the IV, and let nature take its course.
So you starve the patient.
But then
you
that's right. That's active.
They experience that, though. They don't feel that much.
That's in a way, that line between active and passive is also very...
That's right.
Sure, it's awfully great, there's still, I think, a significant moral difference.
No, I disagree. I don't think you can do that, put a little bit less glucose in the nutrients and stop the antibiotics. Then you are in between two lines, and I think you have to... You cannot overall make a decision, but you have to go case by case and discuss it with the patient, and if you cannot do that, with his relatives, which way you want to go. Tell the relatives, let nature take its course, and then slow down the IV. I don't think have to play it open and tell them that I experienced two cases, an 8-year-old boy who had a car accident, and... with his bicycle, and he was unconscious from the start, and we had him for several weeks on respirators with artificial respirations taking place. We nurtured him, we did everything, and we kept him alive, and we hoped that after a couple of weeks, as it sometimes happens and usually happens, they wake up and they might be all right. And this boy started to have seizures, so we knew there was brain damage. And the seizures, in spite of treatment, got worse. And then, as you probably know, you do electrical tracings of the brain and see how the brain is working. We call that EEGs. And if the EEG is flat, then that means the brain is not working at all. Since this boy was in an intensive care nursery, the EEG was never flat. And so, because of all the machinery that is going around, the apparatus, the machine, is always fed by the electrical things that are going around. So this boy did not have a flat EEG, and we had to discuss this with the parents, that after 3 months, we just kept him alive. And we took him out of the intensive care unit and in a private room and repeated the EEG, which was flat at that time. And we disconnected the respirator and the feedings and everything. That was so terrible. And when you say you would never do that, we had a discussion of all the house staff and with the parents. It was so terrible to watch how this little boy died after you disconnected. But sometimes you have to make a decision, and you cannot just say, let nature go its course. And I think in this case, nature just went its course and the boy died. I think you have to make a clear-cut decision and discuss that with the parents or the relatives, if you want to do that. Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate situation in which we find ourselves today is that we are in control over living or dying, which is the reason why the line is so broad, as you have expressed it. Between active and passive euthanasia. We can't really say anymore, no, I'm not responsible, I'm just going to let nature take its course. We can't say I'm irresponsible or I wash my hands of responsibility. We know that we are responsible for the living or the dying of this patient. And I think that we have, under certain circumstances like this one, to be willing to assume the responsibility. And I don't think that we can, in a simple way, say we must let nature take its course. We are responsible, I think.
If we're responsible if we have intruded ourselves and made ourselves responsible.
Precisely.
By nature, that child would have died.
That's right. That's right. We are in control of this now, and therefore we are also responsible if we cease that control.
It does strike me, though, sometimes on a case like that, I know a very parallel situation where a young man broke his neck and the thing was flat and so on, disconnected and everything. It seemed to me there when there's nothing can be done, brain death is in fact present, that one should be as kind to that person as you would be to a dog and put the person to sleep. And that we should have courage in some such rare situation.
But the patient is not living anyway.
I know, but when you see it, I mean, for the whole panel, everybody else, to say, let the person either starve to death or die of what, you know, from the lack of being able to breathe, and to go through all of that struggle and everything else, it seems to me is...
I practice hematology and cancer treatment, and so that about 80 or 90% of the people I treat have some sort of malignancy. And I'm always in that struggle of knowing that I'm going to ultimately always lose, but yet, even you mentioned Hodgkin's disease the other night, at this point, even with far advanced Hodgkin's disease, there's about a 50% five-year cure rate. So even though the patient looks very bad, and people would say, what's the use of doing anything? A physician is in the point where he has to continue to fight against that. I don't think that many of you would want to have a physician who weighted heavily the other way and was just willing to let things slide and, you know, let...
Those are really different issues, though. I mean, in a situation when the decision is made already, there's nothing we're going to let the patient die. There is not one chance in a million, because we have maybe brain death and whatnot, to just let the person die. Naturally, may be much more cruel than in that case.
But many times with my patients, when there's obviously nothing I can do to fight the cancer or whatever, they're very fearful about what this end is going to be like. And what I try to do for those patients is to promise to them that I will do whatever I can to make things comfortable for them. That is pain medication, that is some sort of sedation if necessary, and try to relieve them of this fear of this terrible, horrible, painful death. And there are lots of things you can do.
Yes.
Are we as afraid of death as we are of the process of dying? I don't think anybody is not afraid of being dead. It's the process of dying.
Well, Kubler-Ross, I mean, explains that, and probably the philosophers explain it even better. She says at one point, she says, it's one thing to lose something that we like very much, but another thing to lose everything and to cut off the ties to everything that we have had in life. And we must not underestimate the sustenance that we get. In fact, that's everything, in fact, that we have, the sustenance that we get from our own personal history, from the relations with other people, from the experiences that we have in our vocation. We identify ourselves with these very much, and the cases that I have cited from psychiatry the other night indicate that some disturbance in this identification of self with their world in which they live develops in severe mental and therefore also physical illness usually. I think that it is indeed the death itself, the end of all of those things with which we identify ourselves and which gives us the the sustenance of life, which frightens us. We are historical beings. We don't just live in a vacuum. We identify ourselves with our own history and with relatives. If I understand you correct, you mean to say that the pain, yes, of going through various processes of pain and no longer being capable of caring for ourselves, that's what frightens us.
Or the agony we may inflict on people who care.
I think it is really more than that. We feel the humiliation. We are no longer in control. We can't walk anymore. I remember when my wife was pregnant with her last child, she said, what a different, when she came into the delivery room, what a different feeling it is to be a patient. All of a sudden to lie. And no longer to walk as one who is in control, namely the physician. It's a great difference. But this is not only true for the physician, this is true for everyone. If you are ill, you lie flat on your bed, that the main reason why you feel bad is not because you may feel physically bad, but because you're not in control, because your ego is thwarted a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that comes back to what you said about hope. When you are told that you have some disease and you will die after a certain time, and it's certain that you will and there's nothing that can be done, that is death, because you have no hope. As long as a physician tells you we can do this and that, and there's always a little bit of hope, and then there's always denial, because maybe there's something that can be done anyway and you can still live. But if you come to the point where there's no hope anymore, that is death, and I think that is what we are afraid of. As long as we have hope, we don't have to be afraid.
Yes, and Kubler-Ross writes also that you must always tell the patients the truth, always, but you must never say that there is no hope. Because medically that's probably correct. You must never say that there is no hope. And this is very difficult for the young physician especially to do, because he knows that in many instances indeed there seems to be no hope. Yes?
Well, I think here is where the Christian pastor or the Christian doctor can come in with more than just biological medication.
Right.
Yeah.
And can say that with all the confidence that he's aware of, that God is in control. And that even though we may express momentarily some lack of control in our circumstances, that there is this hope that we speak of that is more than just a figment of the imagination, but is a reality.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of confidence, I think, that is a certain kind of curing, sustaining, healing, even though there is illness and death.
Yeah.
You have to change your perspective. You know, we who are relatively well, look at a whole life. And, you know, we're all terminally ill, whether we accept it or not. But it's out here for most of us right now, at least we think it is.
Mm-hmm.
For a patient who has a disease, it's contracted way down like this. Even if you're only looking at a week, mm-hmm. it's like this, and you can still look for hope within that week.
Mm-hmm.
You can look for maybe a comfortable day tomorrow, which is hope that you might have a better day tomorrow and enjoy having your family come and visit you and so forth, so that just because it's not out here, it's mm-hmm. down here, there still can be hope, although it's on a much more contracted basis.
Yeah, Kubler-Ross talks about, I don't know how much time we have left, I guess
no,
we must
that's not,
we must
that's
break
that
up.
That's